This is Beyond Busy. I'm Graham Alcott. I'm the author of a number of books, including the global bestseller How to Be a Productivity Ninja, and I'm the founder of Think Productive. We work with some of the world's leading companies to help them get stuff done, but more importantly, to help their people to make space for what matters. Beyond Busy is where I explore the often messy truths and contradictory relationships around topics like work-life balance, happiness and success, and explore with interesting people what makes them tick. In short, this is where we ask the bigger questions about work. My guest today is Nick Gold. Nick is chief executive of Speaker's Corner, a speaking agency that lists everyone from Bill Clinton to Malala Yousafzai to Steve Wozniak. He's also the author of a new book, Speaking with Confidence, and he's spent years learning from the best in the world what makes a great speech or presentation. In this episode, we talk about glossophobia, the fear of public speaking, and how to overcome it. I share some experiences from my own keynotes, good and bad, and Nick offers up his top tips for the next time you need to give a talk or presentation at work. This is Nick Gold. How are you?
Yeah, very good, sir. How are you, Graham?
Yeah, I'm good. Good. And where are we speaking to you from?
So I've actually come into my office, I have to be honest. It's a big space, and we've got a meeting room which we've converted into like a studio as soon as it happens. And so it's nice and empty and quiet, and means I can get away from my yapping dogs at home, which is very, always nice.
And are you in London?
I'm in London, based in North London. I ride a little moped, and it takes me 5 minutes now to get from home to the office. And yeah, you know, something I do maybe once a week, maybe twice a week. And it's kind of, it's nice to be in a different space.
When I lived in London, I had a Vespa myself, and that was how I'd sort of dart about London from Whitechapel, where I lived, to King's Cross, where I was doing a lot of work, and various other places. And I always remember like going up places like Old Street and realizing that there's a fair chance that I could die if I do this for too long. So, and now when I think about London, I kind of think that the roads are more hazardous, but do you manage to keep yourself safe when you're riding around?
I do. I have been knocked off, but I got back on because it's the best way to get around London. Like it changes. When I got on it the first time, I realized that it meant I wasn't planning a whole morning around one meeting. I could basically get anywhere in London in 20 minutes. I think if I was 20 years younger, I'm not sure I'd trust myself on it. But I got on my little moped now about 7 years ago, and I drive safely. And I just kind of, it's freedom. It's not going in the underground, and it's not driving a big car. And, what's interesting is when I got knocked off, I used to be a keen cyclist. I got back on my moped immediately, but I can't get back on my bike in London.
Oh, really?
And I think that's because when I drive a moped, irrelevant in the middle of summer when it's 30 degrees, I will still wear my big jacket and my full face helmet. Whereas I look at the cyclists and you've got a little helmet on, you're just wearing normal clothes, and I get worried. But
that's true.
I'm not here to preach about how people should get around London at all. But
I do think it's like, you know, the thing with London is parking is a nightmare wherever you go. If you can find a spot, then, you know, you've worked a miracle, and then you've got to pay for it. Whereas with the thing that's underrated about motorbikes and mopeds and stuff is in most parts of London, you can just find somewhere to park for free, and there's dedicated bays, and it's a very nimble, stealthy way to get around, I think.
It blew my mind when you first get on it. You suddenly realize on every other corner there's a space for these motorbikes, mopeds. And you realize you just need to, and you're just much more aware. It's amazing how much better I know London because I've got my eyes open. When you're in a car, you're kind of very focused and you might just be looking at your sat nav. And when you're walking, you are aware of the surroundings, but you're just kind of aware of the immediate surroundings. But on a moped or a motorbike, you actually take in everything. I do have a sense of freedom from it.
And I hadn't lived in London that long before I started on the Vespa. And what it taught me is how close together lots of bits of London are. Like when you look on the tube map and when you travel on the tube, you think of these places as being all really well spaced out and far away from each other. But you know, when you do it on a bike and you go, oh, like Old Street is just down the road from, you know, London Bridge. Like it suddenly sort of makes London feel smaller and more connected somehow.
I completely agree. So while you were on it, you enjoyed riding it. It was only afterwards you look back now and it's like, that was crazy of me.
That's it. Yeah. I mean, I've probably had a few near misses because it's not so much my riding I'm worried about, me riding safely. It's all the lunatics, isn't it?
Exactly. That is how I feel. Like, you're the dream. You would never do anything crazy, whereas it's everyone else. I completely agree with you on that one.
So we're going to talk firstly about your book and then just about speaking. So you've got this book called Speaking with Confidence.
Absolutely.
Which, as someone who does a fair amount of speaking myself, I really enjoyed.
Thank you.
And your business is Speaker's Corner. You're the MD of Speaker's Corner and have been for a long time. So I suppose my first question is, how did you get into the whole area and the industry around business speakers?
So it's a distant memory. I've been doing it now for about 17, 18 years. But to be honest, I had a couple of companies in the first dot com boom and bust. At the time, it was a lot of fun. And I realized, I look back on it now, and I was young and I was out there talking to people who'd been in retail, like senior people in retail who'd been in retail forever. And I was talking to them about the internet and they were hanging on to my every word. And I look back on it now and realize actually one of the things about speaking is that confidence to deliver a message, irrelevant of your audience, that actually gave me because I knew what I was talking about. And these people who are much more experienced in retail knew stuff like that. But I got away with it because I had this confidence about, I knew more than them about the world of the internet. But I had these couple of .coms, which at one point were worth lots of money. And then the crash happened and they're worth nothing. And I came out of it and realized that actually I didn't really know that much about business. I was just in this bubble and I really need to go work for a big company. So I went to work for Centrica, FTSE 100 company. Stepped in the door, and I have nothing bad to say about the company apart from the polite way of saying it, a big company was not for me, and I had lots of frustrations with the whole thing. But I committed to spending spending 3 years there. I actually ended up spending, I think, 4.5. But from 2.5 years in, it was always, where's my next idea? My next thing is I'm going to start a new company. I need that idea. And actually, my mother-in-law ran a entertainment business. And they're booking magicians and like caricaturists and things like that for weddings and parties. And she noticed this rise of this other thing, which was people saying they'd like someone to come and speak to their audience for 20 minutes at a wedding or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And credit her at the time, what she realized was if you're booking a magician or you're booking a caricaturist, you don't really mind, unless you're booking a big name person, you don't mind who they are. What you just want is someone who can do magic tricks or someone who can do amazing little drawings. But when you're talking about speakers, actually you're interested in what they're talking about, how they're delivering it, and whether they would fit the audience that actually were listening to them. And she realized it was two different separate businesses. One almost was about churn and the other one was about curation. So, and at the time I was helping her because of my background with her website. And we were just talking one day, and as it happens, the story was she was, she had an inquiry because someone wanted a host for, I think it was Hairdresser of the Year Awards, and they were looking for an out there comedian, something different, kind of a great host, but something a bit left field. And it was the time Simon Amstel was on Pop World, for those people who are old enough to remember, on Channel 4. And I turned to her and said, and she was telling me about, she was on the phone to the client and put a phone to the client. She was like, I've suggested everyone I know and this is not working. And I said, they want Simon Amstel. And she said, I don't know who that is. I literally have no idea who you're talking about. And she picked up to her client and she said to them, listen, I've got my son-in-law here. He's doing my website for me, et cetera, et cetera. He's made the suggestion of Simon Amstel, and they were like, this is the greatest idea ever. and she got off the phone and she said, clearly, you've got some gift for this, that, the other. Would you be interested in taking this on? And that's where the idea came from. My brother, Tim, who's my partner in the business, joined me a few years later. And since then, we've grown it. And I think very much to your question about the business speakers, we started in the after dinner and awards host space. And I always talk about two key events happening. The first event being TED, and obviously the rise of TED and speakers appearing at TED, and the fact that actually you got onto a tube in London and everyone had their smartphones and people would be watching these 17-minute speeches of TED speakers. came to a realization that actually thought leadership and people who can deliver an amazing experience is the new rock and roll. And actually it became quite a sexy thing to be discussing ideas and concepts from experience you've had listening to speakers. So that was the first thing that shifted us. And then the second thing that shifted us was the 11 years ago now, the financial crisis happened, and we thought to ourselves, oh, the kind of companies are kind of recession and it's going to be disastrous and everything like that. But what we actually saw coming out of recession, or even quite early in it, is companies realized that they needed to inspire, invigorate their staff and get them to think differently. And the best way they can do that is by bringing external voices to talk to them and actually challenge what their thoughts processes are in order to improve the business, to take the business forward. And that single period of time, we saw a massive growth, and that shift for us away from the just straightforward awards hosting and after dinner, which we still do and happy to talk about that, but much more into this conference and business speaking world. That's quite a long answer to a short question,
there's something quite interesting in the book where you were talking. I think, was it Jonathan McDonald, who's also been on this podcast before?
Oh, fantastic.
Well,
it's lovely to be
back. He was talking about how if a company's had a really hard year, then often they'll run some kind of event for the staff, which is along the lines of, we're celebrating you, we really value you. And part of the motivation behind that is we really need to put our arm around our team and our key people and make sure that, because this year has been really difficult, we don't want people jumping ship and moving off to competitors and stuff like that. And I think we had a similar thing actually with our business, Think Productive, coming out of, so we were kind of born in 2008, 2009, in the middle of that financial crash. And our first assumption, which was totally wrong, was, well, this will all blow over quite quickly, won't it? I'll just be another little recession and fine. And obviously it went on and on. But I do think it's probably similar to you that quite early on in that period, even though people's budgets were slashed, there was an appetite for how can we sort of put our arm around our people and really help them. Obviously, in our case, not just with productivity, but also with work-life balance and dealing with stress and resilience and those kind of key issues. And I think probably we'll end up in a similar place quite soon, right? In terms of, I think there'll be an appetite for that stuff.
I agree. I think it's really interesting. I think one of the things we saw kind of in the financial crisis and also in various events kind of post-financial crisis, and I don't want to get into the world of politics or anything like that, but it was this understanding that when you have someone up on stage historically, and I think very much pre-2009, this is what was felt. If you get an economist up on stage, they are going to tell you what's going to happen from an economic perspective in the future. And actually almost the so-called experts, whatever, they were going to teach us by telling us what's going on. And I think the 2009 financial crisis, people started realizing that people coming up on stage, they're going to give their credentials and you're going to respect and kind of understand where they're coming from. But their opinions are opinions and they're not factually correct anymore. So what I want to do as a regular human being and kind of with my human quest for knowledge is I want to listen to that. I want to respect that. I want to take that on board. I want to get other opinions. And then from that, I can form my own opinion and make my own judgments. And it almost gave us as individuals, because it was such a kind of black swan event, it gave us the capacity to have confidence in the fact that we can have our own opinions rather than being told what to do as individuals. Yeah. And I think that's why the external speaker, the thought leader, came up to be like, here's an idea. You do what you want with it and you use it either for yourself or your business or for whatever purpose, in whatever way you want to use it. But it's an idea that I come up with and you can interpret it as you see fit. There's no right or wrong way to use this.
Yeah. And we're sort of talking about, TED and grand stuff like thought leadership here. But I suppose everybody is a thought leader and everywhere is a stage, right? So let's bring this back to the idea of speaking with confidence, which is also the name of your book. And let's think about this from the point of view of someone who has to get up and make a speech or a talk, let's say even just in front of a boardroom or a small team. And this is the kind of thing that gives people nerves, right? Like there's all those, very well rehearsed statistics that I can't remember off the top of my head right now, but, you know, to do with how people are more likely to fear getting up and speaking in public than dying and all that sort
Absolutely.
Of thing. And it has its own word, glossophobia, which I'd not come across until seeing it in your book, actually. So tell us, why is speaking so scary and why are people so underconfident or unconfident about it?
So it's all about perceptions, because ultimately every day of our lives we deliver speeches, but we just kind of, we don't frame them as speeches, we frame them as conversations, whether they're in a coffee shop with our friends or whether they're just around a dinner table or they're just in general conversation. We are telling stories, which in my mind, a story is a speech. But yet we frame a speech and we picture Barack Obama up on stage delivering something which is kind of entrancing and enhancing and kind of inspirational. And we perceive that being a speech, and therefore we put ourselves against those, we pitch ourselves against those type of speakers, rather than actually understanding that we all have a voice. And actually, as long as this, what we are talking about is something that we believe in and we own that content and own our voice, then we are going to be comfortable in our surroundings. So it's a move away. The concept about the fear of speaking is a move away to being fearful of the content we're delivering or the speech we're making, because actually that is just words that we should own because there are stories. And how do we put ourselves in a situation where we can take pressure away, so we feel the audience in front of us is no longer a barrier to us delivering that speech and no longer our adversarial enemies or whatever we want to call it, and actually they want us to deliver a good time as much as we do. And that changing of the mindset is, to me, is the key criteria for anyone to be able to kind of conquer their fear of speaking. I think we picture it as the worst thing in the world, and we picture it as the biggest nightmare, and we kind of add whether kind of a big event when we know we're going to speak, we spend hours panicking about it and writing and rewriting. But actually, it's not about that. It's about the understanding that every single person in that room, whether it's the smallest room of you with one other person or you in front of 5,000 people, everyone wants a good time. Everyone wants to enjoy it. And suddenly your mood changes and you kind of embrace the situation rather than kind of think you're battling it.
Yeah. There's lots of stuff in the book which I think can really help people to arrive at the point of giving a speech and feel much more confident. But let's just talk about nerves specifically. One of the interesting things that I took from the book was how so many of the speakers who you interviewed still had nerves or still got nervous, and that was still a thing. But just for anyone who just finds themselves shot with nerves, what can you do about it?
So the worst thing you can do when you have the nerves, it's firstly feel like you're alone, because actually the person next to you who you saw go on stage before you went on stage and was really, really confident. You think, well, they didn't have nerves. Everyone has nerves. The truth is you're putting yourself out there in a situation where kind of you are vulnerable. So what you have to do is embrace those nerves and actually not feed them and not feed the nerves, not feed that feeling inside of you. So... And I think, and to me, the best advice kind of I talk about in the book and I believe in is the fact that in those moments leading up to the speech, understand you've got it. You've got the speech. You've done the practice beforehand. The speech is not going to get any better by you rereading that speech for the 974th time. Actually, what is going to make the speech better is by you having a routine which takes yourself away from that moment. And I think kind of, and what do I mean by that? Something might be so simple as in you've practiced. Before I get on stage, my routine is I'm going to go to the toilet. I'm going to make myself a cup of coffee. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. And it's really basic things, but it's just giving yourself some structure that takes you away from thinking, I don't know what to do with myself. I better reread my speech. It's not going to help you. It's just going to raise your the shackles of those nerves again.
Yeah. There's a couple of things. One thing I want to say about that actually is I often get, you know, you get into the dialogue with people where they're trying to book you and so on. And sometimes you get into a thing where someone will say something like, what, you charge that much for an hour of your time, right? And it's like, no, I charge that much for a day of preparation, a day where I'm probably not going to be able to sleep very well beforehand, the day where I'm traveling to the thing, and then a day afterwards where I've got the adrenaline dump of getting rid of the nerves. Like a good one-hour keynote for me is at least like 3 days of my life.
Right? But Greg, but
I have to look at it in that way.
But I think I completely agree with you. Apart from what's interesting and what's challenged my mind over the last 6 months from a speaking perspective in this virtual world we're now in, is this realization that actually it's even more than that. What they're actually paying for is the 30 years of experience and the stories that you've accumulated, which gives you the right to deliver that speech. That's really what they're paying for.
Yeah.
And the truth is kind of how you deal with it as a speaker is something that kind of it's something that you need to deal with it, but it doesn't take away from the fact that they want you for your stories and for your thoughts and for your ideas. And they didn't come to you overnight. They didn't come to you because you sat down and wrote that speech. When you were writing that speech, what you were doing was ordering and taking your stories and putting them in the right places to deliver that speech so you can give the client the messages they are looking for or the ideas they're looking for.
Yeah, and I guess the other thing about that is that, that background and sort of honouring that preparation that goes into it, and the preparation isn't just writing the speech, it's often writing the book that then becomes the speech, you know, doing the research and all of that. And so in a sense, as a speaker, you're in this slightly strange situation where often, let's say there's a year where you're very heads down and you're working on the book, and it's a year if you're lucky, right?
Yes.
Last couple of books I've done have been longer than that. But then when you're going out and then talking about it, it's almost like you've got to earn the money that you didn't earn the previous year because you were just kind of sat in your shed writing. And I'm about to go back into that research and writing mode for sure.
One of the interesting things I always find, especially with professional speakers speakers who have been paid for their speeches, is how they feel the different when they're doing a kind of a speech for the love of the speech or the love of the event, as opposed to a speech which they're being paid for, whether they change their routines and they change how they write that speech or the effort they put in.
I don't even think I recognize those boundaries, right? Sometimes I'm going to deliver something which I'm getting paid for, and sometimes I've agreed to do something for free, but in my head is always, you know, how am I going to get these ideas across and serve that audience? So it doesn't really cross my mind like this is for X amount of money versus this is for free. It doesn't feel like that. So I'll tell you the one exception, actually, if I'm being really honest, was I did a thing in the Middle East earlier this year, about a week before lockdown. And I was I was really panicking about the idea of A, it getting cancelled, and B, it not getting cancelled, but me being stuck in the Middle East when I've, you know, got a kid back home and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
But yeah, luckily I got home.
Yeah,
and that one I did feel more pressured just because of the amount of money they were paying and you know who the client was and everything. Like there was something, I can't really say too much more about it, but it was one where I really felt pressure based on who the audience was, and so it was more who they were than the money. But I think the money probably played into that too, right? It's like, oh man, they're paying me a lot to be here, and they're looking after me really well. Like, I better make sure every word really counts. So I probably just changed my mindset a bit around that.
And do you think you delivered a noticeably different performance, or kind of ultimately you're a good speaker and you deliver a good performance, and kind of maybe it was just a different way you managed your nerves around it because they're different?
Yeah, I think I was just a bit more nervous than I would normally be at the beginning. I think once you get, and this is the thing with nerves, isn't it? I think once you get into the middle of a talk, you're not to say that you're not nervous, but there's kind of like a sense of flow that I hit once I've started.
And I think going back to your question earlier to me about the nerves, especially for those people who aren't the professional speakers and doing it every single day, I think that is actually the critical thing. It's almost if you can understand and appreciate and embrace the fact that those nerves will eventually, because you have because you understand your stories and your content, those nerves you'll have initially at the beginning of the speech, and everyone has them at whatever level speaker you are. But actually, as you get further into something which you feel comfortable with, because you're sharing your experiences and your stories, those nerves will turn into energy. And that energy is what will actually drive the room or drive the audience or wherever you are to make it a truly memorable occasion. So almost the critical thing is not to try and calm the nerves is to actually embrace them and manage them so they can deliver you what you need, which is that adrenaline push to create something magical.
Yeah. There was a couple of things, one from your book and one that I do that I thought might be worth just sharing with the audience. So the one I do, and just someone told me this once and it sort of became a bit of a ritual for me, is that when your face smiles, it's a two-way process. So you can have a happy thought and you smile. But also, if you just exercise your face to the point where you're smiling, it releases happiness chemicals in your brain, and it's like a two-way thing. So sometimes what I'll do is, if I'm feeling nervous before a talk, is I'll go to the toilet and just really aggressively smile in the cubicle.
Brilliant.
So it's just a really stupid thing. And also, if you're sat on the front row, you can do that sat down on the front row, right? No one's looking at your face at that point.
Apart from the host.
Apart from the host or the compere who is just like, what is this guy doing? But yeah, so that's one I'll do quite a lot. And then the one that I really liked from your book was the story about the top sportsman who you observed. And, you know, the story that you tell in the book is, it didn't really feel like this top sportsman really needed the money. But when I saw them do a talk, they just seemed like they were absolutely shot with nerves. And you asked them, well, why do you do this then when you don't need the money? Do you want to?
Yes. I mean, I've been with this sports person earlier that week. And just before they went on stage, they ran off to the toilet. And they just didn't seem that happy. But then they got on stage and they did really kind of, they gave a great job and they got a standing ovation and it was great. And I thought, okay, it's a one-off, whatever happens. And as it happened, I had another job with him. I think, I can't remember whether it was later that week or the following week. And exactly the same thing happened. And I just couldn't work out. I was like, why is this guy putting himself through this amount of nerves or this feeling when he doesn't really need to? I mean, he kind of, even in the sense of, he didn't necessarily need the audience clapping at the end of it, because he was getting that because he could have done just public appearances where he shook some hands. And he was at a high profile and kind of, so he was getting the love out there anyway. So I kind of, listen, I'm sometimes very intrigued about stuff. So I asked the question, I said, what do you think? And he said, you don't understand. I was a professional athlete. And when you're in that stadium, just before your race begins and you've got your heart pounding and you're out there and you're completely raw and kind of, it's just you. That is a feeling that you can't replicate. And this is the closest experience I can get to replicating the whole thing, because it just drives me and gives me a sense of power to overcome those nerves and achieve something when I do get that standing ovation at the end. And it makes me feel good about what I'm doing. And I thought that's an immensely powerful thing over the fact that actually, kind of, however much we get nervous beforehand and whatever we learn, whatever tools we do in order to help us manage it, the reason kind of actually everyone should be embracing the speaking world and actually kind of loving to be given the opportunity to stand up and speak is there is no better feeling. And the truth, and again, it comes back to the fact that when you are delivering that speech, you've got a room full of people who are on your side. And therefore, unless something terrible happened, they are all going to give you a big round of applause at the end, and you are going to feel really, really good about yourself and what you've achieved.
Yeah.
External validation is amazing.
Yeah, you just reminded me of my worst speaking moment ever, which I think I was 22 or something, and my first job was to promote volunteering at the University of Birmingham. And at the time, there was all this money going into volunteering, particularly to promote youth volunteering. So even though mine was student volunteering, which doesn't necessarily always mean young, it was generally younger people. And I'd given this speech to some youth organizations, and I was saying something along the lines of, you know, often the kind of reputation of volunteering is that it's all kind of you know, stuffy old people doing knitting and all this kind of stuff. And actually, like, volunteering can be fun and it will be fun. And, you know, we need to sort of rebrand it and stuff. And then about a week later, I had this other speaking thing. And so that speech went pretty well. And then about a week later, I had this other function, which was in the university, and it was bringing together all these community groups. And I was halfway through sort of delivering that line about how volunteering shouldn't just be about old people knitting. And then as I was delivering it, I looked up and realized that in this case, all the audience were actually quite old. And yeah. I suddenly had just this feeling of like absolute sinking, wanting the ground to swallow me up. And it was like, I really should have understood the audience here and done a bit more preparation. And it was one of those where my job wasn't to be a speaker at that point. My job was to coordinate hundreds of volunteers. And I'd been running around, you know, all week and not even had a second to really think about this thing. And I just thought, oh, well, I did a talk last week, so this is the same thing again, right? So I'll just deliver the same message again. And how wrong I was. But luckily, I think because I was so young at the time, I think they probably just cut me some slack just for, you know, he's new, he's trying.
But it kind of comes back to my key thing, which is, you know, something, people in the audience are always going to cut you slack. So however bad you think that mistake was, they don't want to dwell on it. Yeah. Because actually, yeah. if you are in that room and you're in the middle of a row listening to a speaker, like, and there's nowhere to get out, and so you're stuck there, you're a captive audience, and actually what you want to do is enjoy yourself. So you'd rather kind of gloss over the bits which actually don't go as smoothly, so you can just enjoy the moment rather than sit there and wishing the ground would open up for you.
Yeah, for sure. So let's talk a little bit about some of the things that we can do to help with nerves before a talk. And I really like the bit in your book where you talk about some key questions to help people to understand what the message of a talk is. Do you want to talk about some of those questions?
So can I just take us back a step before we get into the actual questions themselves and say, I think the starting place for anyone in terms of the messaging and what they're going to talk about is they have to own the content. Yeah. And I think this is absolutely, and I think this is where, for me, the number one cause of nerves comes about. It's the truth is, when you're sitting with your friends or your family or whoever it was, and you're telling them a story, you don't worry about, am I going to tell this story correctly? Is it going to be exactly as I want it to be delivered? Because it's your story and it's something that happened to you. And kind of, and actually if you're in a business meeting and you're talking to someone around the table about something that you've got going on, you don't worry about when you're talking about it that it might not be in the order it actually happened. You're telling a story which you own. And I think the starting place in terms of what the speaker is trying to, what you should be doing when you're delivering that speech is to own your content, is to own those stories so you can put yourself in the right environment. And I think kind of, and I do say this in the book, and it's worth saying it. And I do think in a business context, it's even more so. You should never put yourself in a place where you are delivering a speech. And when I say a speech, it could be just in a meeting where what you're saying, you don't 100% believe in.
It's just so obvious. You just find people out really quickly when that happens.
Yeah, and you find yourself out really quickly because you just can't deliver it. I think kind of that to me changes everything about you inside of you because you can turn the whole thing into something which actually is part of yours.
Yeah. Sorry. So the first question you've got is how do you want people to feel?
Yes. So you're a conductor of an audience, and the audience is your other people in the room. And that question about how do you want people to feel is going to dictate about how you deliver that speech, about actually what your messages are, and about the emotion you're trying to get out of the whole thing. Because remember, kind of, and I think my catchphrase is very much around, it's a speaker understanding that they're not the stars, the audience is the stars.
Yeah.
And I again, it's that shift to understanding that what you kind of the best speech that kind of you could ever give, it's not how you perceive the speech to be. It's what people take when they leave that room. And so how do you want them to make them feel is a great starting point for you when you are crafting those messages or crafting that story.
Yeah, this is the thing I'd say to our Think Productive social media team all the time is we're not Luke Skywalker, we're Yoda. Right. And it's like the audience consuming our stuff, they're Luke Skywalker, and our job is to give them those little nuggets that help them go on their magic journey, right?
Yes. And along the way, how they get there, they're going to make mistakes.
Yeah.
And actually, that's part of their journey rather than you sort of thinking to yourself, I control the journey they're on.
Yeah.
You don't.
The second one is, why should people listen to you?
Yeah. Listen, I mean, you get on stage and you've been given the platform to get on stage for whatever reason, or been given the chance to stand at the front of the room and deliver a business meeting, or if you're at a wedding and you're the best man, been given the chance to give the best man speech, that doesn't take away from the fact that actually you should justify about why they should listen to you. And that's not about listing your credibilities or anything like that, but it's giving them the assurance that actually you are going to give them a good time, whatever that good time might be.
Yeah. And there's one, I can't remember who it was, but you were talking about one of the case studies in the book is someone who says the first 2 or 3 minutes of a talk is just about making sure that the audience is relaxed.
Yeah.
And just as long as they feel like, okay, I've got an hour with this guy, but actually it's all, you know, it's all kind of comfortable. Maybe that was Lord Coe. Was it Lord Coe?
Yeah, he eases them in. Like, kind of everyone, you come into that room, you're about to hear, kind of, you're going to hear someone. And maybe this is even more true, kind of, when you're in that meeting, is the fact that actually what everyone wants to do is just take a sigh of breath and say, all right, this isn't going to be a horrible experience.
Yeah.
I almost, weirdly enough, counterintuitively, I always feel sorry for more high profile people, because the expectation of the room is so much higher that actually the level they have to deliver at, they've got to be very, very, very good at the whole thing. Whereas actually, again, for those of us who aren't on stage the whole time and don't have that profile, actually all we've got to do is reassure the audience that, don't worry, we've got this, and they'll come with you on the ride. They're not looking for you to be that great orator, that Seb Coe, or whoever it is. They're looking for you to someone who actually is going to give them, however long your speech is, kind of an experience which actually they can learn from and they can develop from and feel comfortable with.
Mm. It sort of reminds me of, I did a keynote once where it was a part of a big staff conference thing. There's probably 600 or 700 people there. I won't name the company for reasons that will become obvious.
Right.
But I walked in and it was in this conference center, and I was on about third in the morning. So, you know, middle of the morning, I had about an hour, I think. And all the people who were on before and after me were literally stood up on the stage in a line, right? Like Westlife or something.
Right.
But literally just rehearsing like their lines. And so I walked into the room and there's like five different voices, and the next room is like just all the stuff that they're going to say. And I think, and it was so jolting and jarring that it stayed with me. And someone came up to me and said, oh, but you're a professional speaker and you're an outsider, so you probably don't need to rehearse like that. And part of me was thinking, I haven't rehearsed it to that level of detail because I never do. But also it just felt like I think you can get so obsessed with rehearsing every word that what you don't do is connect with the audience and do the bit where people relax and the bit where, you know, you sort of create that space together as kind of slightly hippie as that sounds.
No, but I don't think it is hippie at all. I think kind of the thing about being in a room with a bunch of people and delivering a speech is actually you're all together, and the energy of that room, not the energy of you, but actually the room all together, is what takes everyone to a place where we're all having an experience. I think kind of one of the challenges the virtual speaker now has is, how do you make that connection across a screen? Yes, kind of at the beginning we were saying things like, kind of, everyone's got a front row seat, and don't get me wrong, it's amazing when you've got someone, kind of an amazing speaker, and actually you can see the whites of their eyes, but you've got to break down the barriers. And the breaking down the barriers naturally comes when you're in that room, but actually it's a new challenge and it involves a different skill set to do it across a virtual platform. And I think it's a really interesting thing that obviously as speakers get used to this, how they react to it and how they change their speaking style to cope with it is something that people are learning as they go along.
Yeah. So back to your questions on message. The third one I just thought was really interesting. Do you want the audience to – do you want to be the person who's asking questions of the audience or answering them?
Yeah. I think that's both kind of – this is the expectation of your audience and the expectation of yourself. Are you there to pose them ideas and thoughts which they're going to take away and use, or are you there to give them knowledge which will help them as a foundation in order to do that, to do whatever they've got to go and do? And I think kind of you can deliver both within a speech, but I think you have to be clear and you have to be signposting to the audience what they're getting from different areas. Because I think – without understanding that question, you've got a danger of not having clarity of your speech.
For sure. There's also something really nice about that question, though, because I suppose the other part of it is it gives you that freedom to say, here are the things where I can add information and knowledge. And then also, here are the things where I have a take, I have an opinion, but I don't necessarily think it's the only one, or that I'm in some sort of superior position of knowledge. So being able to sort of own that freedom and that space, in a way of being able to be the person with the prodding questions rather than necessarily the person with all the answers, I just think it's a really interesting.
Absolutely. And I think even hopefully kind of as people feel more and more comfortable speaking, even to the extent where you can pose a question without giving your opinion, because to leave people wanting more and to leave people wanting to have your opinion, it can leave them with something. It's like a cliffhanger at the end of episode 7 or whatever you're watching on Netflix that evening. And I think that's a really important tool which can be used. If you've established credibility and you've told them opinions about this, that, and the other, if you can just pose some questions, just some thought ideas, ultimately it has the capacity to elongate your speech in the memories and minds of people beyond actually the day, because they will be thinking about something and they'll be desperate to find out from you. And for those of you who are book writers or yourself, potentially that could be answered in the next book, which obviously makes your life very happy.
That's true, yeah. And then the last two bits on this, we can probably take together. So one of them is, what do you want the key takeaways to be? And then I really like the way you've summarized this is, if you only had the time to give them 3 points, or they're only going to take away 3 points, what would those 3 points be?
I think the problem is, and I freely admit I've been guilty as anyone of this, what we try and do is we try, especially when you're given limited time to speak and you've got a lot to say about a subject, you try and cram in as much as possible.
Just talk faster, right?
Just talk faster. That's the trait of my life. And if you can distill that down, if you can distill it from the outset down to you to say to yourself, what do you want them to take away?
Yeah.
Then actually everything, your entire speech will come from those 3 points. And don't be scared, not even scared. Don't think you're giving them less by not giving them more stuff to take away. We try and pretend I try and pretend I'm super intelligent. I'm really not. I'm a very simplistic guy. Give me one piece of information and one bit of knowledge and give me time to stew on it and really understand it, rather than giving me 50, which is forgotten the next day.
Yeah, for sure. It honestly took me years and years to recognize that. The other little similar kind of how much content to put in a talk tip that I got given years ago that I really like is, when you're using slides, just look at the number of slides, and you should never have a higher number of slides than you have a number of minutes. So 45-minute talk, no more than 45 slides. And that includes every slide, right? So even the slide that says break or the slide that's the welcome slide, those all count. But it's a bit like, you used to see it on TV sometimes where people talk about budgeting, and it would be, when you go to the supermarket, count how many items, and then that's usually a rule of thumb. You know, that number of pounds is that number of items, kind of thing.
Can I add one more? I'm quite passionate about the subject of slides, and I won't launch into one, but I will say one thing, kind of in terms of the speech, is that if you have those slides and you're using slides, and for whatever reason you are, beforehand practice your speech without the slides. And I say that for two reasons. I say that firstly because it will take away I do often see the nerves come because of the technology, because of the risk of technology failure. So if you know you've got it without the slides, then you're going to be much happier. Also, ultimately, what you don't want to do is be talking to the slides. So by giving the speech without the slides, you know that actually you can be out there talking to the audience and the slides can support you rather than you being a sideshow to the slides.
Yeah, yeah. What have you got any advice for me? So I don't think I have the problem where I talk to the slides. I very rarely have text on slides. They're just images.
Excellent.
And they're there to sort of, back up and place hold and kind of give a visual stimulus to the point that I'm making, rather than, repeat all the things that I'm about to say or, me read them. But the thing for me is that I have a really terrible memory. And so the idea of, like, I watch someone like Jimmy Carr, right, who not only is he on stage for an hour with no slides and no notes, but none of his ideas really fit together, or sort of nothing follows the last one, right? Whereas like if you're a comedian that's telling long stories, or you know, someone who's telling anecdotes, then it's easy to get the flow, isn't it? But I watch Jimmy Carr sometimes and I just think, how on earth, or any of those like one-liner, Tim Vine, those kind of people, how on earth do you do that? Like, how do you sort of have that memory? So is there anything you can say that would help me to create structure so that I, you know, is there something else I can use instead of slides to sort of be that kind of memory jogger and kind of guide through the structure?
So I think there's two things I can say about that, and I think the second part linked to the first one. So the first part for me is anchor it throughout your speech, whether you're speaking for 5 minutes or you're speaking for 45 minutes. Understand there are kind of the anchor points throughout the speech, and there might be only three or four of them, but you know at minute six you're going to deliver, you're going to hit this message, and at minute 12 you're going to hit this message. And then almost if you lose track, and bearing in mind when I say lose track, these are your stories and these are your content, and you're delivering the speech as a kind of it's a conversation. It might be a one-way conversation, but it's still a conversation. Therefore, the term losing track doesn't exist. All it does is you're meandering around a point. You're doing what comedians do, which is you're getting to the point you're trying to get to, but how you got there, you're comfortable in your own skin that you can get there. And if you go slightly off, it's not the end of the world. And it's one of the kind of like, it's one of the great things about slides, is because what they do is they keep you in the direction that you're looking to go.
Yeah.
But actually they don't give you the flexibility that we as human beings naturally do, which is if we're telling our stories, we go off on tangents and actually we draw them back into where we're looking to go. And you fix that in by having set points at key time, because that will help manage the time thing where you are looking to deliver that message, so you are conscious about it and drawing back in. The other thing is kind of, you mentioned Jimmy Carr. This isn't kind of, my story isn't around Jimmy Carr, but it's another well-known comedian I was with one evening, and literally about 30 minutes before he was getting on stage, he scribbled just words all over his hand. I was like, what are you doing? He said, I don't need it, but I know it's a safety of having these words about kind of on my hand. And whether that is on your hand or whether that is on a kind of a little piece of card or something like that, the slides can be the same as having one word. One word that triggers a story or triggers a message, but you just equate it. And it might have nothing to do with each other. It's just what equates it. I came up with this story, and at the time I was making a cup of tea, so all I have is number one tea, and that will automatically take me down that place.
Yeah. And there's that other thing, which is like the rule of three, right, where and three's in pyramids. So you deliver, you know, like beginning, a middle, and end is a three, right? Or this particular thing, what are the three things about this one, and then move on to the next one and have three of those. And so you can kind of pyramid out from three things at the top to kind of nine things below it, and so on.
Yes. And I think kind of you're putting in place patterns which actually sit naturally with your, with both your brain, but also the lyrics of your voice.
Hmm. And I think a lot of great speakers use that rule of three, right? Three, right? So, you know, Barack Obama used it a lot. Tony Blair's thing where he said, you know, the three most important things to me, education. Yeah. I mean, just like such a genius little slogan that people still talk about years later. And it's just classic rule of three, right?
I remember writing, I wrote an article or kind of a blog about the rule of three at the peak of Barrett's kind of speeches. And it's throughout history. It both sits comfortably with the, with the speaker, but also with the audience, because it gives three different messages, but which we can grasp in one go, but also can be delivered and actually sit together so nicely and flow so well. And there are various kind of psychological studies about why the rule of three works so well, and it's a natural thing.
Yeah. I want to talk about a little bit about preparation, and then we'll move on towards the end and just talk about you a little bit and your own productivity and how you work. So preparation, there's so much to discuss here. And, you know, you touch upon some really interesting stuff in the book that was quite reassuring to me, because a lot of it is stuff that I'm like, oh, yeah, no, I definitely do that and I do that. There was one thing, though, that I thought was such a great question, which is, if you're giving a talk, or let's say you're giving a presentation to your board or a team in your organization, is to talk to someone on that team or whoever the sort of client is, whatever the situation is, and ask them what the criteria is for measuring success of your talk. And I just thought that's such a good question, and I don't think I am in the habit of asking it. So do you want to just say a bit more about that? Because it just, it really struck me as a really important point.
I find it fascinating that how we judge whether a speech is good or not. And actually, that's our impression of what we've delivered and actually the audience reaction to it. But realistically, your stakeholders are the people who've said to you, can you stand up on stage or can you be in that business meeting and deliver this? Because we're trying to get this message across. And I think having clarity of what you're trying to get across and what you're trying to achieve out of this is something that will enormously help you when you are writing that speech or when you're preparing your thought. But also, it will massively help you when you go and speak to your stakeholders afterwards and actually have the conversation about whether you delivered what they were looking for you to deliver. Because quite often, and I kind of listen, and this stems from the fact that it amazed me the amount of events that happen. And you say to them, well, what's the purpose of the event? And the purpose of the event is to have an event. We do this every year. We've got to do it again. And then it's like, oh, well, okay. Well, then realistically, what you're looking, you don't really kind of, the speaker you're looking, you don't really mind about the speaker as long as literally they can open their mouth and tell a story. Because you've succeeded it by getting kind of, you're getting all those people in the room or on the Zoom or whatever it was. And to me, kind of as a speaker, that should really disappoint. And that should be, well, I'm not going to achieve anything. I can tell that story, but it's not actually achieving anything. So by asking the question up front, it's a demonstration also that you are in, you have a vested interest in giving your stakeholders, or kind of, and that's very business speak, but your people around you, actually what they really want out of the whole thing. And quite often it's a question which they wouldn't have really considered, because kind of their immediate thought, well, we want a bunch of happy people. And in my view, everyone should be able to leave an audience feeling happy, or kind of, when I say happy, feeling kind of having some emotion at the end of the speech. The question is actually, what do they want beyond that?
Yeah, absolutely. In the last 10 minutes or so, I just want to get onto a couple of very standard, beyond busy, fair kind of themes. And one of them that just struck me is, so you talked at the beginning about how you had a couple of companies during the dot-com boom that were doing really well. And then, you know, they valued very highly at one point, and then that valuation was cut drastically during the crash. And of course, you know, the year that the speaking industry and the events industry has just had with COVID, you know, feels like there might be a parallel there. So I'm just interested to know what your reflections are across your career, just about highs and lows and how you've dealt with highs and lows.
I think the starting place is kind of, it's my feeling that actually I want to enjoy myself. Why did I go back to start a new business? Is actually, I went in there primarily, and I know it's a very trite thing to say, but I went there to enjoy myself and have a smile on my face and actually enjoy the roller coaster journey I knew I was going to go on. So even right at the beginning, and for the speaking industry, kind of effectively fell off a cliff kind of in March when lockdown happened, because suddenly all events were cancelled. And we had to take kind of action, and actually a lot of it kind of, it was tough and it was hard, but at the same time, I kind of, for my team, for myself, it was a very open journey. So for those people kind of, for whatever everyone experienced, we were doing it all together. And actually, kind of, I think the best way to describe it is that in the days leading up to the lockdown, when we all knew it was going to happen and we'd already seen, and we were dealing every day with tens of events being cancelled, kind of as it built up, literally, my person who ran the day-to-day, she turned, kind of, we were coming in together one day, she turned to me, she said, I don't understand, Nick, you are the most miserable person of all time. All you do is have walk around the office kind of with a furrowed brow and all that sort of thing. Yeah, you've been coming in the last few days kind of, and you've been smiling, and you've got, it's like a massive weight's been lifted off you. And I said, yeah, because I said to her, well, I suppose here's the thing, is actually, like, when I'm in the office and I see kind of what we could be doing better, I take personal responsibility over the fact that I've let you guys down because I haven't given you the necessary tools, whatever it was, in order for us to be delivering amazing service to our clients. So I feel that myself. Whereas actually at the beginning of the pandemic, kind of throughout this entire thing, this, whatever we would have done, we couldn't have impacted what was going on out there. So it's like, this is not my responsibility.
Yeah.
And therefore I'm just kind of, I'm going to go along for the ride. And don't get me wrong, I'm not being flippant about this. I'm not saying that I didn't have many dark moments and continue to have dark moments. I mean, it's really not enjoyable at all. But it was like, it's that fact that actually there's some sort of relief over this was not, this is not because we did something badly. And I think that's kind of, and maybe that does come from the first, kind of the dot-com crash, kind of for those who remember it ultimately. It was kind of, we all knew it was going to happen. And maybe in the pandemic, we didn't know it was going to happen. We all knew it was going to happen. But that doesn't mean that it was our fault that it happened. And therefore, you kind of, you deal with it when it's there rather than worrying about what could I have done differently.
Yeah, there's something about the ego that we attach to decision-making, right?
Yeah.
And how often the stress that you feel around a decision is to do with how the results of that decision will leave you being perceived.
Yep.
And I mean, very frivolous and sort of different example, but a few years ago I did this whole year of extreme productivity experiments, and one of them was to make decisions by the throw of dice. Okay. And the idea was to sort of take on this mantra that, you know, any decision is better than indecision. And so just if you're stuck, just come up with two or three or six different options, throw the dice, and then just follow it. And so I thought it'd be a really good thing to just reduce procrastination. But I think my biggest learning was the fact that it felt really freeing. It was like, well, that was the dice's decision. It wasn't mine.
Yeah.
You know, and it just allowed in a similar kind of way. You know, it's like whatever we do, we can be responsible for doing our best right now in this circumstance.
Yeah. But and I think,
if we don't hit targets, it's kind of, it's not our fault, really, is it? You know,
I think absolutely. And I think the key thing for me was the fact that I was very, very, very transparent to the whole team. And it meant for the sizable majority, we had to let people go, unfortunately, and we kind of had to do with stuff. But for the sizable majority, there were no surprises. In fact, there were times saying, thank you for taking us on the journey and being honest all the way through. And I think that's what we could control. And that kind of, it meant that we were in it together, which is a big thing. It kind of, and like they all knew, they all could see what was going on because they were dealing with the cancellations. They were dealing with that. So there was nothing to hide. And that meant that it was a shared experience, however horrible it was. Or it is a shared experience, however horrible it is. And I think that's what I really, and I don't know, but that's what I took, and that's how we've been dealing with it the whole way through.
So when you sit back in 5 years' time with your feet up by the fire and you remember the COVID crisis of 2020, is there like one thing that will stick in your memory as a highlight or lowlight?
So it's a really interesting question. I think the lowlight, which possibly might also be the highlight, is a conversation I had quite early on. It seems to be a conversation I had quite early on, where I can't remember how it came about, but I was with one of the team, and I think it was coming to the end of lockdown, but we were in the office because we had an event, we had to do a virtual event, and therefore we were doing some filming or something like that. And again, excuse me, but kind of for not remembering exactly, but the conversation went about like how I felt at that time and kind of what my biggest fear right then was and whether the business was going to survive, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I turned to the point and I said, no, actually, my biggest fear out of this is that we don't kind of both, and this is both for our business, but also for society as a whole and kind of for the events industry and everything like that, that actually, as it does come back, as the world returns to whatever it's going to become, that we haven't learned anything from what's happened over the last 6 months. And still, that's my biggest fear, is actually we've seen kind of, we've been challenged as individuals, as businesses, in terms of purpose and in terms of what we hope to achieve. And I flippantly say, we've all been sitting at home during lockdown and kind of we haven't been able to go out. And suddenly, actually, the fact that you've got that little bit of kind of, the fact that you haven't spent that money that weekend that you would usually spend, it meant that that hasn't got as much relevance. What you really want is you want that little bit of kind of free time or work-life balance or whatever words we want to use around it, And the fear for me is that we just slip back because the pressure of life gets to us and we go back where we are. And then the flip side of it, I think the best thing could happen is actually we learn these lessons and we find some compromise. Because I think kind of almost we are at a stage right now of the other extreme, which is no one ever wants to go back to work again, and everyone wants to just be at home and lead their own lives. And there has to be some balance. There's going to be some settling of everything. And hopefully us as a society can take ourselves to a better place. I know that's a big kind of thing to say, but I do worry a lot that we won't learn.
That's the thing. It feels like one of the big themes through 2020 has been the idea of, you know, focusing on what's really important, remembering what matters, you know, and really a kind of chance to take a step back and question how we do stuff. And obviously the title of this podcast is Beyond Busy. So I suppose the final question that leads on from that is, do you feel like your relationship with busy will be the same as we sort of get back to a post-COVID vaccine world of normal? And what do you think is the best way for you to kind of healthily manage your own relationship with busy?
So I think I will still be busy. I think the answer is yes, but I think how I rank what I want to be busy with is going to change. And I think one of the, and I was talking just today about it with my team, about the fact that one of my biggest fears is kind of, not my biggest fears, but one of my concerns is the fact that actually, hopefully, if as business starts picking up and we are looking to recruit in 2021, me conquering my nerves about the next pandemic. Now, bearing in mind, this is a once in how many hundred years type of event. Why have I got those nerves over the fact that could something come along tomorrow and drop everything off? Unless I conquer those nerves, then my fear is, in terms of the busyness, is the fact that we end up running the business on a streamlined thing, which doesn't give me the capacity to make my choices about how I rank what I'm going to be busy doing.
Is that like a scar from this year?
Yes. It's 100%. It's a scar from this year. And it kind of, which I know is an irrational scar. But my worry about it is, because of the irrationality of it, what is going to make me inside just feel like, okay, kind of, we need kind of, I had a good, whatever we want to call it, busy life, which I was satisfied and comfortable in back last year or beginning of this year. COVID hit, the pandemic hit, we've now gone beyond it. I'd like to get back to that, but I don't want to go through the pain of kind of what we've been through over the last 6 months.
Yeah.
It's irrational, but it needs to be dealt with.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, this is one of the things I often say in talks around productivity, which is the only thing that unites us is that humans are weird. And what's funny is that you're already labeling that as irrational. And, you know, we all do this, right? We have things that we've labeled as irrational, but it's still, we can't out logic ourselves with that stuff. Even the irrational things, you know, stick in our brain when we know they probably shouldn't. So
yeah,
really interesting. I feel like we should probably revisit this conversation in a year and see how that scarring is and if you've managed to conquer it.
I'd love to. Yes, absolutely.
But just to say, Nick, just really great to have you on Beyond Busy. Tell us where people can get in touch with you and get hold of the book and anything else that you want to share.
So it's kind of, you can find me at Speaker's Corner. Kind of my email address, please contact me, is nick@speakerscorner.co.uk. Happy to talk about the world of speaking, or if you're thinking you want to be a speaker, or if you'd like to book a speaker, please do get in contact with us. The book is out next week. Very excited about it. Hopefully kind of, it's going to appeal to everyone because it gives you just some, as Graham, you kindly said, some great tips about how you can manage yourself to be an amazing speaker, because we can all be it. I can't stress that enough. Available at all good bookshops and on Amazon. I've never thought I'd be saying that, but there we go. But hopefully it's a good read. Ultimately, it's got a kind of, I was privileged to interview with some amazing, amazing speakers and people who share kind of knowledge. And it's amazing how kind of all speakers, however famous or whatever they are, they all experience similar things and deal with them in different ways, which is what comes out through the book.
Yeah. And I mean, I could just say as a speaker as well, like it's really practical. And I was kind of picturing someone on a train on their way to do a talk. And it's the kind of book that you could put just in your bag and take with you, or just have in the car with you. And then it's there as your little comfort blanket, yes. Right? Like you can just open it up and just find little nuggets that will help you on every page, but it's very accessible.
Thank you. I think that's what really I was trying to read. That's so, yeah. Very much what I was trying to get out. It's kind of, it's actually the least important thing is the structure and the English and the everything else. And the most important thing is you're comfortable in yourself and you can stand up and kind of and pretend that you're in the pub with a friend and having a good time.
Yeah, for sure. So yeah, definitely benefits from the wisdom of all of your many years working with lots of top speakers. So congratulations on it again.
Thank you so much, Dean. Thank you for allowing me to come on with you. It's been a lot of fun.
So there you go, Nick Gold. And it feels a bit nostalgic listening to that, doesn't it? The idea of people doing events in rooms and all that sort of thing. One day we will all be together again. Hey, it's coming. A couple of thank yous. I've got to thank Riz, my producer on the show, not only for producing this episode, but for the recent transition into our world of YouTube as well, which I'll talk about more in a minute. But Riz has just put in some really solid hours over the last couple of weeks in dedication to Beyond Busy. So just want to say a massive thank you to Riz. And the whole team, actually, who've really pulled together around Beyond Busy over the last few weeks. So really grateful to be working with you all. And Think Productive, our sponsors for the show. So if you want productivity training and coaching, if you want us to come in and help your team, we have a whole range of workshops, including things like getting your inbox to zero, how to fix meetings, working from home. We've got a whole range of stuff that will really help. So go to thinkproductive.com and you can find out more there. I want to say thank you to everybody who reached out after the Seth Godin episode last week. Felt like a really big one. It landed really well. As you can imagine, just Seth is just full of value bombs and just really lovely pithy little quotes and stuff. People really appreciated it. So I loved doing it and had so many lovely reactions to it. So just want to say thank you to everybody who dropped me emails and DMs and WhatsApps and whatever after last week. And if you want to sign up for my weekly email, it's called Rev Up for the Week. The idea is every week I send you a positive or productive idea for the week ahead. Comes out every Sunday evening, and you can sign up by going to grahamalcott.com/links. And there you'll find links to Rev Up for the Week, links to the podcast, links to my relatively new still book, which is called How to Have the Energy, and lots more stuff. So just grahamalcott.com/links. And yeah, final thing I'm going to say today is we try and keep this podcast free and free of advertising. We want to bring as much value and as little interruption as possible. But it does cost money and it costs a lot of effort, and there's a lot of emotional labor that goes into making these. And we don't ask for any payment in return. But what I would love is for you to just help us out here with a couple of things. So if you're not subscribed to the episodes, please go to your podcast app and just subscribe. That would just make our day, and it really help us to get our subscription numbers up. So just go to your podcast app, subscribe to Beyond Busy there. And even if you are going to continue listening to these on audio rather than video, I'd love you to just go to YouTube and subscribe to my channel on there. So the channel is just called Graham Alcott. It's basically brand new. We've got a handful of subscribers on there. The views are starting to go up for the Seth Godin episode, but it's all on there. So subscribe to the Graham Alcott channel. Give the Seth Godin episode a view on there, a like on there, a comment on there. And that would just really help. So we don't want your money, but we'd love you to just support us in that way. And of course, if you want to share this with other people who you think would find it valuable, that would mean a lot to us as well. So please forward this on. Send the episodes to people that you think would be really helped by them, and that would just help us too. That's it for this week. We'll be back next week with another one. And wherever you are, I just want to say, if you're in the UK, then just stay warm and stay safe. And we're nearly through this thing, right? It feels like a lot of people are really struggling right now. So stay safe and warm. And not long to go now. We're coming through the other side. It's happening. Spring's here. So that's what I want to say at the end. So we'll see you next week. Until then, take care. Bye for now.